Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12, and you'll also receive a complimentary 6 months of digital access to The Telegraph for free.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud, the podcast where a few writers each week from the magazine read out their articles. This week, we hear from Douglas Murray, and he asks why anyone would want to be a government advisor in light of what's happened to Tony Abbott. And then we hear from historian Francis Pike about Thailand's modern Caligula. And at the very end, Philip Hensher reads out his review of Alex Ross's new book about Wagner. First, Douglas Murray.
Poor Tony Abbott. It would seem being Prime Minister of Australia doesn't bring you to the attention of the British media. To come into its sights, you must be put forward for a role as UK trade advisor. Then they will discover your existence and aim to destroy whatever reputation they didn't know you had, with the usual modern British charge sheet. This time, the charge was led by Kay Burley. The latest advertisements for her Sky television show boast that Burley is always formidable, rigorous, fair, honest, and searching, among much else. Perhaps Burley hadn't seen the advert. Certainly, she displayed no such qualities when she discovered the existence of Tony Abbott. She immediately asserted, didn't prove, just asserted, that Abbott is a homophobe, a misogynist, a climate change denier, and wishes to kill the elderly. She then spent the next couple of days pursuing this line of attack in a fair and honest manner, obviously, until Abbott's appointment was confirmed late last Friday evening. By that stage, the rest of the anti-Tory media had joined the game. "Pressure on PM to drop misogynist trade advisor," said the front page of one left-wing paper. A day later, the appointment having been confirmed, the same paper ran the headline, "PM appoints misogynist Abbott as trade advisor." If I were an averagely incurious young person, this is the sort of thing that would worry me. The UK government knowingly promotes women haters. Who are these monsters? But more exercising than the behaviour of parts of the media was the now traditional limpness of the Conservative ministers put up to defend their proposed appointment. First up was Matt Hancock, and even the NHS badge pinned to his lapel could not ward off the evil spell words Burley threw at him about Abbott. While Burley did the full homophobic misogynist killer of polar bears and the elderly shtick, Hancock managed just about to splutter something about Abbott knowing about trade. He almost said, notwithstanding. A day later, the equally wet Grant Shapps had the same smear sheet recited at him by Burley. He too seemed incapable of finding any words to defend the former Australian Prime Minister. With that extraordinary brilliance one tends to associate with Shapps, he pointed out that Abbott had not yet been appointed. He then filled up some time talking about modern society, conversations and respect, by which he did not, of course, mean respect for anyone who might still be a Catholic. "Would Shapps agree to have a drink with a man of Abbott's views?" asked Burley rigorously. She, firmly and indeed formidably, stated that she would not. For a moment, Shapps seemed to be weighing up the issue, as though drinks with Shapps are a widely recognised honour, almost as much as having a drink with Kay Burley. When people wonder why there are so few Conservatives in public life, these are the occasions they should reflect on. For not all people put forward for such positions have the distinction of being a former Prime Minister of a close ally. Anyone now put forward must be aware that, however minor the role, it will entail their being accused, without any evidence, of all the same sins of which Abbott was accused. And instead of being given a robust defence by your own side when the left attacks, you will find Hancock, Shapps, or James Brokenshire, if you're lucky, defending your whole life, work and character. So, while there may be some Tory rejoicing when one of their appointments is squeezed through, all the time the desire of sane people of the right to enter public life diminishes even further. Personally, I find that these episodes bring out my vengeful streak, a streak which is otherwise carefully hidden. After watching the treatment of Tony Abbott, I started dreaming of scorched earth strategies. If the left are so intent on hurling the same boring accusations and the right are going to remain so cowed, then why not give them some of the strong stuff and be done with it? Put Tarki in charge of reforming the BBC, or make him the next head of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Push him through, let them squeal, and everyone else afterwards might be treated with a shade more understanding. As it happens, another ally of this country has answered part of the problem in a slightly more practical way. Last week, President Trump announced that from now on, all those divisive white privilege training sessions for government staff will be stopped. They are, the administration correctly said, propaganda. The British government would do well to follow this. Currently, in order to get any public position or to work for the civil service, you must jump through a whole course of entirely left-invented hoops. These include things like having to prove your commitment to diversity. If you are white or male, let alone white, male and heterosexual, this is a tough call. And so people boast about their commitment to left-wing causes and swear fealty to left-created ideas. By now, this has had an effect. Of course, not all Tories are as wet as Hancock and Shapps, but it is aggravating to hear the occasional right-wing Tory burst out about the left-wingery of universities or the wokeness of the BBC, while these same ministers preside over public appointments bodies and a civil service absolutely packed with implicit bias training and the whole rest of the crock divisive social justice agenda. The same might be said of the police as well. If the Conservatives cannot put up someone like Tony Abbott for a position without him being fired at in the manner in which he was, then it is time to change the game. The way to do so is not just to drop the whole falsely termed social justice agenda, but to strip it out of the heart of government, like the mental and moral asbestos that it is.
That was Douglas Murray, and now the historian Francis Pike.
The Roman Emperor Caligula was renowned for his extravagance, capricious cruelty, sexual deviancy, and temper bordering on insanity. Most famously, before he was assassinated, he planned to appoint his favourite horse as a consul. This is probably a legend. But King Maha Vajiralongkorn, who ascended the throne in Thailand in 2016, adopted Caligula's playbook for real. In 2009, the then crown prince promoted his pet miniature poodle, Fufu, to the post of Air Chief Marshal, in which capacity he served until his death in 2015, aged 17. Fufu's cremation was preceded by 4 days of formal Buddhist mourning. The poodle first came to the attention of the general public when a video was released showing him eating cake from the hand of Vajiralongkorn's third wife, Princess Sirasmi, while she cavorted in a G-string in the dog's lavish birthday party. At a 2009 gala dinner in honour of Vajiralongkorn, Fufu was kitted out head to paw in black tie dress and, according to a WikiLeaks revealed account by US Ambassador Ralph Boyce, jumped onto the head table and began lapping from the guests' water glasses, including my own. When on parade, the new king wears crisp, snowy-white, gold-braided, Ruritanian military uniforms, or elaborate Thai regalia that make him look like a Buddhist temple in human form. In downtime, his dress can best be described as kinky. Trainers and low-hung jeans paired with the skimpiest of crop tops. His back and arms are festooned with possibly fake tattoos. Vajiralongkorn is famously lecherous. Indeed, in his youth, Thai aristocrats would pack off their daughters to Europe to get them out of his clutches. Happily for Bangkok's elite, the crown prince's tastes, after his divorce from his first wife, an aristocratic relative of his mother, were consistently low rent. His second wife was an aspiring actress, albeit of the soft porn variety. The marriage did not last. After Vajiralongkorn put posters all over the palace accusing her of adultery, she fled to London and later to the US with her children, apart from a daughter who was kidnapped and brought back to Bangkok. The daughter was elevated to the rank of princess, but her mother and brothers had their diplomatic passports and royal titles revoked by the crown prince. The Thai public was left horrified by his treatment of his family. Another marriage followed in 2001 to the aforementioned Sirasmi, though it was not publicly announced until 2005, when the crown prince, by then in his early 50s, declared that it was time to settle down. However, in 2014, he stripped his wife of her royal titles because of her relatives' corruption. Sirasmi's parents were jailed for 2.5 years each for lese majeste. 5 years later, on the 1st of May last year, and just 3 days before his official coronation, Vajiralongkorn married for the fourth time to Suthida Tidjai, a former Thai Airways hostess, giving her the title of Queen Consort. The Thai people were dumbfounded when, just 2 months later, the new king named his mistress, Major General Sininat Wongvajirapadji, as his royal noble consort. It was the first time this form of address had been used for more than 100 years. The new relationship lasted 3 months. On the 21st of October, Sinina was stripped of all her titles and disappeared from public view, supposedly for being disrespectful to the queen. The king's extravagance is no less remarkable than his private life. A monarchy that was impoverished in the post-war period had, by some estimates, increased its wealth to between $40 and $60 billion by last year. Most of the wealth resides in land. Ownership of some 4 square miles of central Bangkok makes the Thai monarchy the world's wealthiest by a large margin. Overseas holdings include a major stake in the Kempinski Hotel Group. Indeed, for years, Vajiralongkorn has spent months on end at the Munich Kempinski with his harem and servants. In addition, he owns a mansion on Lake Starnberg to the southwest of Munich. In spite of his huge allowances as Crown Prince, affording him ownership of 2 Boeing 737s, it is thought that the then Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra had to cover his gambling debts. Why do King Vajiralongkorn's private shenanigans matter? Royal families throughout Europe have long weathered sexual and financial scandals. Juan Carlos may have been forced to step down as king and go into exile, but the Spanish monarchy has survived. So too has the Belgian monarchy after the former King Albert II admitted to having a love child. There is no suggestion that Prince Andrew, cherubic by comparison with King Vajiralongkorn, will bring down the British royals because of the Epstein imbroglio. But the key difference is that, unlike Thailand, all those are constitutional monarchies. In Thailand, the monarchy is integral to the country's real power structures. This was a 70-year legacy of Vajiralongkorn's father, King Bhumibol. Bhumibol's reign started under a cloud following the killing of his 20-year-old predecessor, King Ananda Mahidol, by a single shot to the head with a Colt 45 pistol. After a questionable trial, two servants were executed for the murder, though it is widely suspected that the king was accidentally shot by Bhumibol, his brother. For the first decade of his rule, King Bhumibol was entirely powerless and lived under the rule of the quasi-dictator Field Marshal Phibun Songkram, who, during the Second World War, had allied Thailand with the Axis powers. But gradually, as Thailand inched towards a democracy, Bhumibol won the adoration of the Thai people thanks to his moderating influence and good works, such as paying for medical facilities for the poor. His political power increased. In 1952, he bravely refused to preside over ceremonies for Phibun Songkram's new militaristic constitution. However, Bhumibol's finest moment came in 1981 when he faced down the so-called April Fool's Day coup d'etat by fleeing Bangkok and raising the Thai royal standard at the military base at Korat, where General Prem emerged as the new military strongman. There followed what is now known as the Network Monarchy Era, a coalition of military interests and those of the financial and industrial elite based in Bangkok. As a former American deputy president at Thailand's Bank of Asia noted, Thai politics has been about dividing up the pie among the elite. At the centre of the web stood the Thai monarchy. Elected democratic institutions remained largely an adornment to this oligarchic structure. In 2001, a business chancellor and mobile phone billionaire, Thaksin Shinawatra, later the owner of Manchester City Football Club, swept to power with his Thairak Thai party, promising a popular agenda, including reform of health and education. Much to the chagrin of the network monarchy, Thaksin won a sweeping victory again in 2005. Bhumibol, who loathed Thaksin, gave tacit support to the coup that first removed him and then sent him into exile 2 years later. Until his death in 2016, Bhumibol thwarted, either by military or judicial coup, the democratic will of the Thai people, who, since 2001, have consistently voted into power Thaksin-backed parties and their proxy leaders. Bhumibol's historic reputation, albeit tarnished by his thwarting of the democratic will, became an important pillar of resistance to Thaksin's outsiders. After Bhumibol's death in 2016, the critical power of the monarchy was left in the hands of his dissolute playboy son. Will King Vajiralongkorn redeem his dire youth reputation and do a Prince Hal, moving to the path of royal righteousness? The signs so far are not good. Just over a week ago, the royal noble consort, Sininat, suddenly re-emerged with no information other than an inventive Royal Gazette announcement. It will be regarded that she never was stripped of the royal consort title, military ranks, and royal decorations. More important than this saga of extraordinary extrajudicial fiat, the king intervened in the drafting of a new constitution by the military junta in 2017 to grant himself new powers over the appointment of regents. In addition, the new constitution asserted the king's right to manage during any constitutional crisis. Given that Thailand has had 17 military coups since 1932, this is not trivial. Two crack regiments have also been put under his direct control. As the political exile and professor at Kyoto University, Pavin Chachaval Pongpun, has noted, the king is basically running the country now, though he's not doing it like his father did through moral authority. He's using fear to solidify his position and to take command. It is therefore interesting that in the past month, demonstrations of up to 10,000 people have called for the powers of the king to be curtailed. Protesters have defied Thailand's draconian laissez-majesty laws, which can incur up to 15 years imprisonment. They have chanted, "Down with feudalism." It remains to be seen whether the protests are a straw in the wind of future political instability. The new king's attempt to transition from a monarch with influence within network monarchy to a monarch who rules is fraught with danger. But at least Vajiralongkorn is unlikely to come to Caligula's sticky end. The king has a ready-made home for an exile in his beloved Bavaria.
That was Francis Pike, and now a review by Philip Hensham of Alex Ross's Wagnerism, Art and Politics in the Shadow of Music.
In the early 1920s, a French businessman, Léon Bell, was looking for a name for his new brand of processed cheese. He remembered seeing a meat wagon on the First World War battlefields with the sardonic name La Vacherie. Like the Valkyries in Wagner, it brought solace to fallen soldiers in the field. Bell thought it would do very well and gave his cheese the same name in a more orthodox spelling, La Vache qui rit. The laughing cow is still very popular today. Reading this completely unsuspected story of a trademark in Alex Ross's book, I wondered with some astonishment at this world. A businessman, looking for a striking name for a mass-market product, hits on a joke about the title of a 5-hour German music drama written 70 years earlier. And it succeeds. His market actually knows what he's talking about. Wagner gripped the communal mind for decades after his death in 1883, and he's not done with us yet. Ross has written a book about Wagner's consequences with one striking omission, what he did with music and what he did to music. Wagner was, above all, a composer. The power of his musical invention is the reason why he is still in our lives. All other mythical dramatists, contrivers of theatrical spectacle, political theorists and grubby purveyors of national and racial theories from his time have disappeared, as Wagner, without his music, would certainly have disappeared. Nevertheless, it is possible, as Ross has found, to write a very long book about his influence which has almost nothing to say about the music itself, and which doesn't find it necessary to talk about the music that was shaped by him. Ross quotes an American mythographer saying that Wagner's two great successors are James Joyce and Thomas Mann, rather than, for instance, Debussy and Schoenberg. It's an eccentric approach, but entirely possible. Many of the best creative minds of the time were immediately engaged by... Many of the best creative minds of the time were immediately engaged by Wagner's endeavour. Between the 1850 Weimar premiere of Lohengrin and the 1865 premiere of Tristan und Isolde, Wagner had written 4 full-length operas and 2 acts of another. Concert performances had built up interest across Europe. By the time of the construction of the theatre in Bayreuth solely for the performance of his work, and the first production there in 1876 of the full cycle of The Ring of the Nibelung, Wagner was probably the object of more feverish intellectual speculation than any artist in the world. One more music drama followed, Parsifal, expressly written for the unique Bayreuth design and acoustics, and confined to performances there until the 20th century. The division between Wagner and Wagnerism was already apparent in the composer's lifetime. In many of the best houses even today, you can be ticked off for applauding after the first act of Parsifal, rather than filing out in sacramentally silent awe. The tradition goes back to the original performances, but it's recorded that the audience member who was indignantly hissed for yelling Brave at the flower maidens turned out, when the lights were raised, to be Wagner himself. Once he was dead, and control passed to his terrifying widow Cosima, all bets were off. Ross does a very good and full job in tracing the obsession of different times and places and the intellectual flavour each wave took. The young George Bernard Shaw's take on the ring, a socialist allegory, or the mystical withdrawal into Teutonic obscurity of French poets from Baudelaire to Mallarmé and onwards. Oddly, Ross doesn't mention the wonderfully self-named poet Tristan Klingsor. There are passages about the cult of Wagner in Japan, surprisingly early. Children's guides to Wagner were being published in 1928, and about the philosopher's Wagner. In my view, you'd be about as likely to buy a ticket for Götterdämmerung on the basis of its philosophical content as you would be to base your plans for international world domination on a round of Risk. But Wagner was deep in Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche was torn in two by his fascination with, then rejection of, the composer. Philosophers have continued to gnaw at his work. As time went on, Wagner proved more and more prophetic. The theatre at Bayreuth is astonishingly reminiscent of a cinema, with its total dark, invisible source of sound, an apparently floating stage picture. Filmmakers have gone on stealing from him, from direct allusion to probably unconscious theft from what is probably now common mythical currency. Tolkien took the idea of the ring from Wagner. It has no other source, and Parsifal stilling Klingsor's thrown spear in mid-air turns up at the climax of The Matrix. The question at the centre of this study, of course, is Wagner's responsibility for and relationship with Hitler. There's no doubt that Wagner, like many 19th century figures, was personally anti-Semitic in a more than casual way. There is also the point that Bayreuth was very happy to be used by Hitler as a venue for one of his festivals of Teutonic culture, just as Himmler turned Quedlinburg into a centre of hieratic pilgrimage. Wagner's politics are complex, however, and went through a series of different stages. In the 1920s, German commentators quite reasonably regretted that the idealistic, revolutionary spirit of equality apparent in Wagner had been lost to a fascist faction of admirers. The claim that there is anti-Semitism in the operas themselves runs up, in my view, against some awkward facts. First, there's no evidence that opera productions during the Third Reich ever depicted the characters Mima and Beckmesser as Jewish. Hitler never made any kind of comment on Wagner's attitude to the Jews. Most of the Nazis detested Wagner and even denounced the compassionate conclusion of Parsifal. There's nothing in any of the opera's music which unarguably indicates that a character might be Jewish, though musical conventions were well established. The vile caricature in Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition predates The Ring. Ross is very conscious of the complexity of these questions and how they have become more complicated with the passage of time. His omission of much consideration of Wagner's music has the curious effect of making those who were obsessed by him sound somewhat deranged. This, however, is not always inappropriate, and much of the story is inevitably of gross misuse on both sides. Thomas Mann wrote very truly of the malicious abuse to which this great object somewhat lends itself. That goes both for the Bayreuth audiences in the 1930s rising to salute Hitler in the last scenes of Die Meistersinger, and the conspicuously non-musical polemicists who have since attempted to erase Wagner from concert programmes on the unproven and implausible claim that his music was played daily in the concentration camps. It was more likely to have been Schubert. Ross's book is excellent and extraordinarily thorough. Though one occasionally misses a musically literate person saying something intelligent about Wagner, Debussy on the orchestration of Parsifal appearing illuminated from behind, or Berlioz saying that the Tristan prelude was nothing but appoggiaturas, there are plenty of books about that. Leaving the music to one side, Ross's is a very thorough account of apparent delusion in search of a fugitive meaning. In the end, one can only say that what Wagner created in pure sound is of such power that it will always survive the worst of its creator's character, and the characters of the worst of his admirers. What it means was perhaps best accounted for by, of all people, the novelist Philip K. Dick. Parsifal is one of those corkscrew artifacts of culture in which you get the subjective sense that you've learnt something from it, something valuable or even priceless, but on closer inspection, you suddenly begin to scratch your head and say, wait a minute, this makes no sense. It might be a description of all of the greatest art, and in the end, the message over which posterity laboured so hard is secondary to darkness falling in a room in northern Bavaria. Silence. From the depths, the single note of A flat in unison from wind and strings. It starts.
That was Philip Hensher. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and do join us again next week.